introducing new laws intended to gag Muslims' freedom of speech.
In the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offense called political Islam in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists but are preparing the ground for it.
Across the English Channel, a new conspiracy has been widely circulating, claiming that Muslims are somehow responsible for spreading the coronavirus. These ideas are not supported by any facts. However, the belief was so widespread it had to be debunked by a government fact-checker website. These are just a few examples, but studies suggest that Islamophobia is present at nearly all levels of society. Vaccines are being produced to stop COVID-19, but what is being done to defeat racism against Muslims?
Protests in Pakistan against Israel over its unending atrocities in occupied Palestine has not been so unusual. People in Pakistan have traditionally supported Palestinians in their struggle against Israel since 1948, when Israel killed and expelled Palestinians in a mass number and occupied their land. Many here rally behind leaders beyond Pakistan's borders over their support for Palestinians. One such leader is Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, a top Iranian commander who resisted against Israel and backed Palestinians at a time when many Arab rulers not only abandoned Palestinians but also collaborated with Israel to suppress them. That is why many took to the streets in Pakistan after a US drone assassinated General Soleimani in Iraq 1 year ago. Being victims of so-called war on terror, Pakistanis view the US and its allies in a negative shade. Anti-US and anti-Israel sentiments have been high in Pakistan for decades. So are some of the Arab rulers who have been under fire for normalizing their ties with Israel at the expense of the sufferings of the Palestinian people. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
After dozens of civilians, including Ghadi's government officials, were killed and injured in the attack on Aden Airport, the deputy head of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, Hani bin Baraik, accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind it, ruling out that Sana'a was involved in it.
It's clear who's behind this latest attack in Aden Airport is the one who benefited the most from this attack, and is United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates and its forces in Aden, because United Arab Emirates doesn't want to be there a government which can actually express the term Yemen, or which can actually be in Aden. That's why United Arab Emirates, they want south of Yemen to be divided, all Yemen to be divided, so the United Arab Emirates can control Bab al-Mandab and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, and as well control Socotra Island. And
videos that went viral on social media showed that the missiles were launched from inside the Green City in Aden, which made observers accuse the STC of seeking to push back Hadi's government to Riyadh hotels and fail the Riyadh agreement. The deputy head of STC had preempted the arrival of the new Hadi government with a campaign to raise the flags of South Yemen in private and public facilities, including Aden International Airport, and he also warned members of the Hadi government not to talk about Yemeni unity, which confirms the continuing tension between the two parties to the conflict in southern Yemen.
There is no place for Hadi and his government in Aden. This is the message that the attack on the airport carried, meaning that Aden will continue to suffer under the rule of the militias of the UAE-backed STC. Abdul Latif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author tells Press TV he started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of our Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
Shahid Soleimani turned into the champion of the Iranian nation and the Islamic Ummah. What happened following his martyrdom was the first hard slap delivered to the U.S., That great popular movement was the first slap delivered to the U.S. and after that, our brothers delivered another one. However, the hardest slap is a software victory over the hollow power of the arrogance. This is a hard slap that should be dealt to the U.S. Our revolutionary youth and our religious personalities should shatter America's hollow power with their determination and they should deliver another hard slap to it. This is the first slap. Another one is to expel the U.S. from the region. This requires the determination of nations and the policies adopted by the resistance front. They should fulfill this duty. This slap will be a hard one.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor.
These measures are different from taking revenge on the assassin. The measures that I refer to are related to arrogance and the U.S. in their entirety. Soleimani's assassin and those who issued the order will pay the price. This is another issue in its own respect. Of course, according to a dear personality, even Soleimani's shoes are worth more than his murderer's head. And even if his murderer loses his head, Soleimani's shoes will still be worth more. This is true, but after all, they have done a wrong thing and we should take revenge against them. Both those who ordered his assassination and the assassins themselves should know that we will take our revenge in due time, at the proper time.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah,
the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terence fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
January the 3rd marks the first anniversary of the U.S.'s terrorist assassination of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Now, the general was the ultimate anti-terror figure in the region, who had been successful in countering Daesh, al-Nusra Front, and other terrorists who had been brought to the region. Stay with us as we talk about the commanders of the resistance to terrorism and hegemony on this debate. As commemoration ceremonies are taking place throughout Iraq, there we have seen commemoration services taking place in Syria, in Lebanon, and now Iraqi people have gathered and have lit candles, and of course showing their respect for those two brave commanders and others who were killed in that U.S. terrorist attack 1 year ago. A commemoration ceremony in the Iraqi capital for General Soleimani. I'd like to welcome now my guests to the program, out of Pittsburgh, author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik, and the director of Rasalis Strategic Studies Institute, Dr. Sam Mathitorabi, out of Qom. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start it off with Daniel. Now, Daniel, what we saw take place almost a year ago, from an international legality perspective, we would definitely say illegal, definitely against international law, and yet nothing has been done. It seems even talked about, really, that something was going to be done from the so-called international community. Your assessment of this?
Well, I think the U.S. has effectively destroyed, international law, at least as it applies to the United States. It has undermined its enforcement mechanisms, for example, by sanctioning the International Criminal Court because it wants to investigate U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. has made it clear that it believes it's above the law, and the international community either can't or won't force it to abide by international law. Another example of this, of course, is that the U.S. lost an International Court of Justice case to Iran, I believe it was last 2019, over sanctions. And so the U.S.'s response was to say, well, we're not going to honor this decision. And by the way, we're withdrawing from the International Court of Justice, which is the highest court in the world. So we see time and again that the U.S. Has found a way to evade international law, and sadly, I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Okay, viewers, if you're looking at the live images there, you see, well, you were looking at those images actually from the actual site of where the assassination had taken place last year. That was live images out of Baghdad there, where people had gathered to commemorate. Sam, when we look at the situation, and we go back a year ago, with Donald Trump basically saying, yes, he ordered the assassination, do you think that there was a miscalculation there? Or why do you think that the United States ordered this assassination to begin with?
Good evening, Nazia.
Good evening.
Well, you know, we have to understand the context of the Syrian war. The Syrian war was the closest thing we've had to a world war since World War II, if you don't count the wars that existed in Africa, which some have also counted as world wars. So in this quasi-world war, you had on the one side the U.S. and its allies, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the NATO countries, Turkey, and of course the Takfiris that they used as their mercenaries and as the, you know, head of the spear, so to speak, to destroy Syria and Iraq. And on the other side, you had the people of Syria, the people of Iraq, the resistance with Iran as its leader, and of course then later Russia joining after Haj Qasem Soleimani went and personally spoke to Putin about the strategic and historic threat that this issue represents. And in this Syrian war, and in this world war, the result of this war was that the U.S. and its allies were badly defeated. And so when you have the Americans deciding that they're going to assassinate the main commander of the of this war, because according to everyone, Haj Qasim was the main commander of this war. He was the one that led the war, especially the ground war. So it seems that this was almost out of spite. This was out of a reaction to having miserably failed in this war, in this world war, having experienced a strategic defeat exactly the way they did in Iraq prior to that, during their own during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And so, as far as I can tell, this was basically just trying to kill the person who had defeated them.
Well, Daniel, what about that? You heard our guest and Colm say basically it was a reaction because of a strategic defeat. With that being said, then, is it that the United States not only does not care about security in this region, and basically many would say has been behind much of the turmoil, but even in Europe, because we know these same terrorists that caused such havoc in this region also did the same in certain European cities?
Yes. Well, I think that certainly part of what the U.S. wanted to do with the murder of Soleimani was to, as my colleague said, to get retribution against a military commander that had outsmarted them in theaters like Syria. But I also think and I fear that another goal of that murder, as well as the recent murder of the nuclear scientist in Iran, is to try to provoke a war with that country. The U.S., particularly under Trump, for the last 2 years, has tried to engage in incredibly provocative actions, hoping that Iran would overreact and give some type of justification for an armed intervention. So far, Iran has shown itself to be very restrained in its responses, very smart in its responses, and has managed to avoid that. I hope it is able to do that in the next 3 weeks, because, you know, there is a lot of noise out there that Trump may be wanting to start a war before he leaves office in 3 weeks.
Okay, Sam, your take on that. Do you think that this was about basically the United States wanting, or as our guest in Pittsburgh said, that Trump wants to start a war with Iran, or is it something else?
Well, let's first see if he leaves office in 3 weeks. That's still a question, number one. So that's the first thing. The other thing is, and we talked about this with my colleague the last time we were on the debate together, which is that from the Iranian perspective, a U.S. attack is actually strategically beneficial to Iran. It allows Iran, it gives Iran the moral legitimacy and the legal right to take military action against all U.S. interests in the region, and to expel the U.S. from the region, from West Asia. So this is something that the generals in the Pentagon know. And, you know, one of the interesting things, and this is something that our viewers should know, the main group in the U.S. who is against the war with Iran is the Pentagon, because the Pentagon knows that they would lose such a war. So whether it was the Bush Jr., or whether it was now Trump, or any other president who was saber-rattling and was thinking about starting a war with Iran, it is always the Pentagon and the military leadership that prevents these U.S. presidents from actually launching a war against Iran, because a war against Iran would actually be the end of U.S. presence in West Asia. And the end of U.S. presence in West Asia basically ends U.S. global, any sort of attempt by the U.S. to maintain global hegemony. And this is something that comes out of these statements and the analysis of the Americans themselves. This is not, you know, my analysis or some sort of a claim. This is something that if you look at the literature by U.S. strategists over the last 70 years, particularly after they became the inheritors of the British in the region and in the world, they inherited the British Empire after World War II, one of the central claims and one of the central issues is having control over West Asia. So for the U.S., it always weighs between losing its position in West Asia and attacking Iran. And so far in these 40 years, it has chosen not to attack Iran directly. It has always done it through proxy, whether it was with Saddam during the 8-year imposed war, or whether it's, you know, through other forces, terrorism or economic war, or psychological or whatever, all these sanctions and wars that we've experienced over the 40 years. But it knows very well, when I mean it knows, I mean the Pentagon, and I mean those who actually know war. Mm-hmm. They know that if they engage in a direct war with Iran, it would be the end of U.S. presence in West Asia, and it would be the end of U.S. hegemony in the world.
What about Daniel, when we look at this assassination and the goal behind it, many would say that probably the United States wanted to have a devastating effect on the resistance, and what experts are saying, especially in this region and beyond, is that they have not only stopped the resistance, but actually it is more fervent than ever because of that assassination. Would you say that the United States miscalculated or not by making that move, that the situation has actually gotten worse for Americans in the region?
It may have miscalculated. On the one score, that, as you say, I think the resistance, particularly in Iraq, to U.S. presence has now grown. It was right after that that the Iraqi government made it very clear it wanted the U.S. to leave. And Iraq continues to want the U.S. to leave. And I guess the other miscalculation is, again, if I'm right, that they wanted to draw Iran into a greater conflict, that they were unable to do that with the murder of Soleimani because Iran did not overreact. So in two different ways, I would say the U.S. miscalculated.
Well, Sam, how much of this, if you look at what the U.S. had claimed throughout the years, that they were actually fighting Daesh and fighting terrorism in the region, and then, of course, then they kill the ultimate anti-terror commander in the region. Do you think that actually that facade was taken away for those who still believe that the U.S. was actually fighting against Daesh, or how do you see it?
Well, actually, Trump was the one that tore down the facade. He did it during the elections 2016, where he talked about the Americans sponsoring Daesh through the Saudis and the Turks. And also, the interesting thing is this, that when you have you actually have Trump, when he becomes the president, talking about, he actually said it, he said, we will let the Iranians and the Russians beat Daesh, and then we'll take on the Iranians. He literally said that. So it was clear from the beginning that the Americans in the Trump administration were waiting for Daesh to be taken care of by the Iranians and by the Syrian people and by the Iraqi people and the Russians and the resistance forces. And then after that, they were going to go after the Iranians. Now, you've mentioned a couple times the word miscalculation. Well, the entire U.S. approach to Iran over the last 40 years has been a miscalculation. It's based on false information. It's based on propaganda by Iranian exile groups who have no idea what's going on in Iran. It's based on the delusions and illusions that exist in Tel Aviv and Riyadh and Abu Dhabi about Iran. And it's basically a closed bubble in which people talk to each to themselves and suggest policies and act on policies and implement policies which have no connection to the reality of what Iran is.
Why is that the case? Why is that the case? Almost 42 years later, since the victory of the revolution in Iran, why are they still miscalculating when it comes to dealing with the Islamic Republic?
Well, first of all, let's not say that that's a bad thing. You know, it's a good thing that they don't understand us. And if they want to continue not to understand us, that's fine with us. The point is that they come from a background which is an imperial background. It's not the imperial background of the British, where they would directly come and take over a country, but they are the inheritors of the British Empire in this region, and they claim to be the hegemon and they have the right to do anything they want in this region. And the most important aspect of their strategy in the region is to not allow governments that are based on the will of the people. So if you look at Saudi Arabia and all these, states in the southern Persian Gulf, they are medieval, family dictatorships. If you look at Israel, it is a apartheid state in which a minority is occupying a majority. And so for the first time in the region, you have a country like Iran, who has a popular revolution that establishes a republic based on a written constitution. You know, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a written constitution. Israel doesn't have a written constitution. It has the Westminster system. And so you have a state in the Islamic Republic whose leadership and whose system is based on the will of the people. So this is the root of why the Americans can never come to terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Because Iran is an independent country and its power is based on the people.
Stay with me. Well, Daniel, what about that? Sam talked about the will of the people, and actually, after the assassination of General Soleimani, we saw millions of people taking to the streets, not only in Iran, but in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, actually mourning what had happened and promising that they would seek revenge and that they would be united in their demand that the United States must leave West Asia. Your take on all of this, because it seems that by actually this terrorist attack that the United States committed, that they increased the solidarity of the people in the region and their determination to make sure that the U.S. leaves this region.
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, General Soleimani was a very popular figure, not only in Iran, but in Iraq as well, in Syria as well. It seems to me that they picked the wrong person to go after there. They delegitimized themselves. Again, they didn't get Iran to react in a way that provoked a major conflict. They clearly overshot the mark on this one. And I think the U.S. will pay for this for a long time, because I think the region will continue to reject the United States' presence there. And I think this assassination, as you say, only increases that resolve.
And Sam Mahdi, your take. I mean, we saw after the assassination, we saw little kids actually in the streets here in Iran saying, "I am Qasem Soleimani." That basically young people are saying that they will continue his way. The legacy that he's left behind, and where do you see as far as the resistance going from here?
Well, let's just be clear that there's no American kid saying that, you know, "I am General Petraeus." There's no Israeli kid, you know, saying, "I am General, you know, whatever the latest murderer from Israel is." So the reality is that we have people like Haj Qasem, like Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. These are people who worked on themselves for an entire lifetime as a spiritual matter. I think the most interesting aspect of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi's life is their spiritual life. Of course, you know, this is not the place to maybe discuss it, or maybe we can talk about it at some other forum. But that's the reality we have in these people who are deeply spiritual people. They are not, you know, Wall Street weapons lobby generals who have to, you know, resign from the CIA because they had an affair with their mistress. These are not people who are revolving door generals who, you know, go and fight in Iraq and then become lobbyists for the weapons industry and then now are becoming defense secretary. So it's a completely different worldview and model of how a human being has to live, how a commander and a general and a soldier lives, and it is something that's completely lost in the West. They don't have it anymore. There might have been something close to that when you look at people like General Marshall, you know, who from the famous Marshall Plan, and you know, who spent almost 60 years of his life in service. And when he was asked at the end of his life, you know, "Will you write a memoir?" He said, "I don't want to profit privately from my public service." Can you imagine a U.S. general saying this today? So this is the thing. We shouldn't assume that because they both have uniforms, we're talking about the same species. These are two different species, and this is the point about General Soleimani, and this is why he was so popular, and this is why he's a hero across the world, not just in this region, but across the world.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Sorry, we're out of time. Author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, and director of Risalat Strategic Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi out of Qom. Appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, we appreciate you staying with us on another debate. Bye-bye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Vice President Mike Pence signaled support on Saturday for a futile Republican bid to overturn the election in Congress next week, after 11 Republican senators and senators-elect said they would vote to reject President-elect Joseph R. Biden's victory when the House of Representatives and Senate meet to formally certify it. The announcement by the senators and Mr. Pence's move to endorse it reflected a groundswell among Republicans to defy the unambiguous results of the election and indulge President Donald Trump's attempts to remain in power with false claims of voting fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times columnists Luke Broadwater, Maggie Haberman, and Thomas Kaplan. The piece is titled, Pence Welcomes Futile Bid by GOP Lawmakers to Overturn Election. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence signaled support on Saturday for a futile Republican bid to overturn the election in Congress next week, after 11 Republican senators and senators-elect said they would vote to reject President-elect Joseph R. Biden's victory when the House of Representatives and Senate meet to formally certify it. The announcement by the senators and Mr. Pence's move to endorse it reflected a groundswell among Republicans to defy the unambiguous result of the election and indulge in President Donald Trump's attempts to remain in power with false claims of voting fraud. Every state in the country has certified the election results after verifying their accuracy, many following post-election audits or hand counts. Judges across the country and a Supreme Court with a conservative majority have rejected nearly 60 attempts by Donald Trump and his allies to challenge the election results. And neither Mr. Pence nor any of the senators who said they would vote to invalidate the election has made a specific allegation of fraud, instead offering vague suggestions that some wrongdoing might have occurred and asserting that many of their supporters believe that it has. The senators' opposition to certifying Joe Biden's election victory will not change the outcome, but it guarantees that what would normally be a perfunctory session on Capitol Hill on Wednesday to ratify the result of the presidential election will instead become a partisan brawl, in which Republicans amplify specious claims of widespread election rigging that have been debunked and dismissed for weeks, even as Donald Trump has stoked them. The spectacle promises to set a caustic backdrop for Joe Biden's inauguration in the coming weeks, and reflects the polarized politics on Capitol Hill that will be among his greatest challenges. It will also pose a political dilemma for Republicans, forcing them to choose between accepting the results of a Democratic election, even if it means angering supporters who dislike the outcome and could punish them at the polls, and joining their colleagues in displaying unflinching loyalty to President Donald Trump, who has demanded and in increasingly angry fashion that they back his bid to cling on to power and to the presidency. The conundrum is especially acute for Mike Pence, who, as President of the Senate, has the task of presiding over next Wednesday's proceedings and declaring Mr. Biden the winner, but has his own future political aspirations to consider as well. On Friday, a federal judge dismissed a lawsuit brought by House Republicans to pressure Mike Pence to do otherwise, and instead unilaterally overturn the results. But on Saturday evening, Mark Short, Mike Pence's chief of staff, issued a statement saying that Mr. Pence shares the concerns of millions of Americans about voter fraud and irregularities in the last election. The vice president, the statement continued, welcomes the efforts of members of the House and Senate to use the authority they have under the law to raise objections and bring forward evidence before the Congress and the American people on 6th of January. In a joint statement on Saturday, the Senate Republicans, including 7 senators and 4 who are to be sworn in on Sunday, called for a 10-day audit of election returns in disputed states and said they would vote to reject their electors from those states until an audit was completed. They did not elaborate on which states. The group is led by Senator Ted Cruz from Texas and includes Senators Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, James Lankford of Oklahoma, Steve Daines of Montana, John Kennedy of Louisiana, Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, and Mike Braun of Indiana. And Senators-elect Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming, Roger Marshall of Kansas, Bill Hagerty of Tennessee, and Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. Together with Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who announced this week that he would object to congregants' certification of the election results, they bring to nearly one quarter the proportion of Senate Republicans who have broken with their leaders to join the effort to invalidate Joe Biden's victory. In the House of Representatives, where a band of conservatives has been plotting the last-ditch election objection for weeks, more than half of the Republicans joined a failed lawsuit seeking to overturn the will of the voters, and more are expected to support the effort to challenge the results in Congress next week. Representative Mo Brooks, Republican from Alabama, has said he will object to certifying the results, and with Josh Hawley's support, that challenge would hold weight, prompting senators and representatives to retreat to their chambers on opposite sides of the Capitol for a 2-hour debate and then a vote on whether to disqualify a state's votes. Both the democratically controlled House of Representatives and Republican controlled Senate would have to agree to toss out a state's electoral votes, something that has not happened since the 19th century and is not expected to happen this time. In their statement, the Republicans cited poll results showing most members of their party believe the election was rigged, an assertion that Donald Trump has made for months, and which has been repeated in the right-wing news media and by many Republican members of Congress. A fair and credible audit, conducted expeditiously and completed well before 20th of January, would dramatically improve Americans' faith in our electoral process and would significantly enhance the legitimacy of whoever becomes our next president, they wrote. We are acting not to thwart the democratic process, but rather to protect it. They also acknowledged that their effort was likely to be unsuccessful, given that any such challenge must be sustained by both the House of Representatives, where Democrats have a majority, and the U.S. Senate, where top Republicans, include Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the majority leader, have tried to shut it down. We fully expect most, if not all, Democrats and perhaps more than a few Republicans to vote otherwise, the senators wrote. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, the top Democrat on the Rules Committee with jurisdiction over federal elections, called the Republican effort a publicity stunt that would ultimately fail, but said it was dangerous nevertheless, amounting to an attempt to subvert the will of the voters. Amy Klobuchar noted in an interview that hundreds of millions of votes had already been counted, recounted, litigated, and state certified across the country. These baseless claims have already been examined and dismissed by Trump's own attorney general, dozens of courts of law, and election officials from both parties, said Mike Gwynn, a spokesman for Mr. Biden's campaign. While lawmakers have sought to register their opposition to past presidential election results by challenging Congress's certification, the move has generally been more symbolic than substantive, given that the loser had already conceded and senators rarely joined with members of the House to force a vote. But as Donald Trump continues to perpetuate the myth of widespread voter fraud, a growing number of Republicans in Congress have been eager to challenge the results, either out of devotion to the president or out of fear of enraging the base of their party that still reveres him even in defeat. That is the case even though the vast majority of them just won elections in the very same balloting they are now claiming was fraudulently administered. Mr. Mitch McConnell has discouraged senators from joining the House effort, and Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number two Republican in the Senate, told reporters the challenge to the election results would fail in the Senate like a shot dog, prompting a Twitter rebuke from President Donald Trump. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, on Thursday condemned the attempt, calling it a dangerous ploy intended to disenfranchise millions of Americans. Senator Ben Sasse accused fellow Republicans of making a political calculation to try to further their careers at the expense of the truth by tapping into Donald Trump's populist base. But Josh Holmes, a Republican strategist, and Mitch McConnell's former chief of staff warned that those involved in the effort would come to regret their stance. Rarely can you predict with 100% assurance that years from now everyone who went down this road will wish they had a mulligan, Mr. Holmes wrote on Twitter. Senator Patrick Toomey, a Pennsylvania Republican who has announced that he will not seek re-election in 2022, also blasted the effort, saying that Mr. Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, and others were directly undermining the right of the people to elect their own leaders. For years, Donald Trump has railed against contests in which he has lost, disliked the outcome, or feared he might be defeated. He objected to the results of the Emmys, falsely claimed President Barack Obama did not win the popular vote, asserted that Ted Cruz stole a primary victory from him in Iowa in 2016, and predicted that the election in which he defeated the Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton would be rigged. In the months leading up to November's election, he also warned that he would be cheated out of a victory and refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power. As for Joe Biden, racked up victories in November, Mr. Trump indulged in increasingly outlandish fictions, spreading disinformation about the election results and encouraging his followers to challenge the vote at every step of the way. In recent weeks, as his legal defeats have stacked up, the president has become more vitriolic in his condemnation of Republicans who failed to support his false claims of having been the true victor in the election, and has lavished praise on those who parrot his accusations. On Saturday, Donald Trump cheered on the Republican senators who announced they would object to certifying the election results, writing on Twitter, "Our country will love them for it." The vote tally and procedures in every battleground state that Donald Trump contests have been affirmed through multiple post-election audits. Joe Biden won the election with over 7 million more votes than Donald Trump, and with 306 electoral college votes, surpassing the threshold of 270 needed to win the presidency. Nevertheless, more than a month after Joe Biden's victory, with increasing numbers in their party marching in lockstep with Donald Trump, some Republicans felt the need on Saturday to explain why they plan to vote to uphold the results of the election, of a Democratic election. "I swore an oath of allegiance to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and that is what I will do on 6th of January," Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska said in a statement. She is to face voters next November. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah warned of the consequences of backing a bid to subvert the election's outcome. "I could never have imagined seeing these things in the greatest democracy in the world," Mitt Romney said in a statement. "Has ambition so eclipsed principle?"
Good morning. morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.